I swung my legs over the edge of the bed. I found a clean tunic and leggings and dressed. The view from my window showed me a beautiful summer day. I let the curtains drop back into place and then took a deep breath. Life wasn't about me anymore, I discovered. It surprised me to realize that it had been so. Molly, I thought to myself. I had believed that I spoiled her with my attentions and gifts. Actually, she was the one who had spoiled me, allowing me to wake in the morning and think first of what I needed to do that day, rather than what someone else needed done. The wolf in me had been correct. When I tapped softly on Bee's door, and then entered at her muffled invitation, I found her awake, and considering a variety of garments she had taken from her little clothing chest. Her blonde hair stuck up in tufts. "Do you need any help with that?" I asked her. She shook her head.
"Not with clothes. But Mama always stood on the other side of the bed as we made it each morning. I've tried, but it doesn't go straight for me."
I looked at her effort. It had probably been like trying to raise canvas on a ship by herself. "Well, I know how to do that," I told her. "I'll make the bed for you."
"We are supposed to do it together,"
she rebuked me. She took a deep breath and squared her little shoulders.
"Mama told me that I must always be able to take care of myself, for few in this world will make allowances that I am small."
Yes, Molly would have thought of that. "Then let's make it together," I offered, and followed her very precise directions to do so. I did not tell her that I could simply tell one of the housemaids that this was now her task. What Molly had carefully built in our small daughter, I would not tear down. She shooed me out of the room while she dressed herself. I was standing outside her door, waiting for her, when I heard the tap of Nettle's boots on the stone-flagged floor. She halted in front of me, and it was not flattering that she was obviously startled to see me there. "Good morning," I greeted her, and before she could respond, the door swung open to reveal Bee dressed and ready to meet the day.
"I did brush my hair,"
she told me as if I had asked,
"but it's too short to lie flat."
"Mine too," I assured her, not that I had even attempted to make it do so. She looked up at me and asked,
"Does it make it hard to trim your beard too?"
Nettle laughed, as much to hear her sister speak as to see me uncomfortable. "No, it does not," I admitted gravely. "I've just neglected it." "I'll help you before I go," Nettle offered, and I wondered how she knew it was a task Molly had often undertaken. Bee looked up at me solemnly. She shook her head slowly.
"There's no reason for your beard anymore. You should just shave it off."
That gave me a twinge. How had she known? Had Molly told her that I had grown it in an attempt to look closer to my true years? Perhaps later. But now, we should go down to breakfast, for your sister wishes to make an early start. Bee walked between us, and at table she essayed a few words to the staff, but mostly muttered to her plate. Still, it was a start, and I think even Nettle saw the wisdom of letting her reveal herself slowly. The farewell was hard for all of us. Bee endured a hug from Nettle, but I would have held my elder daughter longer in my arms if she would have allowed it. Her eyes were bright as she bid us farewell, and I promised that she would hear from me regularly. She looked down at Bee and charged her to
"Learn some letters and write to me, little Bee. I expect you to try as hard as your papa to make this work."
It was well for me that Nettle did not see the guilty look Bee and I exchanged behind her back. Riddle had stood silent and watched us make our partings. He approached me then with a grave face, and I thought he would offer me awkward words. Instead, he suddenly engulfed me in a hug that nearly cracked my ribs. "Be brave," he said by my ear, and then released me, walked to his horse, and mounted, and they all rode away. We stood in the carriageway of Withywoods and watched until Nettle and her party were out of sight. A time longer we stood there. Steward Revel and several of the other servants had turned out to bid Nettle farewell. They ebbed away from us until only Bee and I were left standing there. Birds called from the woodland. A light morning breeze stirred the leaves of the white paper birches that lined the carriageway. After a time, Bee ventured a single word.
Well.
Yes. I looked down at her. What was I to do with this tiny girl? I cleared my throat. I usually begin my rounds with a walk through the stables. She looked up at me and then quickly away. I knew she feared the large animals of the manor. Would she go with me? I could scarcely blame her if she refused. But I waited. After a moment the small blonde head nodded once. And so we began a new pattern that day. I wished I could carry her, but knew that she dreaded my touch, and why. And so she trotted at my heels, and I walked more sedately so she could keep up with me. We walked the stables and conferred with Tallerman. He was visibly relieved to see the guests departed, and his workload returned to normal. Lynn the shepherd glanced once at my small follower and then spoke to me while his dog gravely poked Bee under the chin with her nose until Bee petted her. The vineyard required a horseback trip. When I told Bee this, she seemed to consider it for a longer time before informing me,
"I have not checked on my mother's beehives for some days. I do have tasks of my own, you know."
"I don't know how to help you with the hives," I told her. She lifted her head and again squared her small shoulders.
"I know what must be done, and I'm stronger than I look," she told me.
And so we parted, but came back together for a noon meal. I reported to her that the grapes had an excellent set, and that I had seen many of her bees busy at their work. She nodded gravely to that, and said all had appeared well with the hives. After our meal, I retreated to the Withywood study to go over the long-neglected accounts. There was a list from Steward Revel there of maintenance projects for Withywoods that he judged too important to ignore. There were small notes next to some of the suggestions in Molly's handwriting. I couldn't bear to look at it. She'd put it there at least 2 months ago, and I had promised her, that we'd get the most pressing work underway this summer. But I hadn't. I'd set it aside, confident that she would nag me into action when it became urgent. Well, she wouldn't. Not ever again. There were other messages on my desk, accounts that needed to be paid for supplies brought in from the outlying farms. There was a lot of tallying to do for men who had worked the hayfields in exchange for a share. Here was a note that we'd have to hire more workers for the grape harvest, and if we wanted good ones, we'd best secure them now. Everything needed to be done now. And another list, poorly written and spelled worse, of various foodstuffs. I stared at it for a time. I must have looked perplexed because Bee wandered over to peer past my elbow at it.
"Oh, Cook Nutmeg wrote that, I think. She always asked Mama what meals she would like for the week to come, so Cook could be sure she had all she needed on hand for them. Mama used to write the list for her to send to town."
"I see. And this?" She scowled at it for a minute.
"I'm not sure. I think that word is meant to be wool. And that might be cobbler. Mama was talking of winter woolens for the help and new boots for you and me."
"But it's summer." She cocked her head at me.
"It's like the garden, Papa. You have to plan now what you want to have 3 months from now."
"I suppose." I stared at the unintelligible scribbling, wondering if I could somehow persuade Revel to translate and assume command of whatever this was. It was suddenly all too much. I set it down and pushed away from the desk. We should go look at the apple trees. And so we did until evening. Day by aching day, we groped toward a routine. We made our needless daily inspection of the stables, the sheep pens, and the grapes. I did not throw myself into the work. I did not have the focus. But the accounts did not go too late, and Revel seemed almost relieved to take up the meal planning. I didn't care what he put before me. Eating had become a task to accomplish. Sleep evaded me, only to ambush me at my desk in the middle of the afternoon. More and more often, Bee followed me to my private study in the evenings, where she amused herself by pretending to read my discarded papers before drawing lavish illustrations on the backs of them. We talked little, even when we played games together. Most evenings ended with her asleep on the floor. I would carry her back to her bed, tumble her into it, and then return to my study. I let go of far too many things. I felt sometimes as if we were both waiting for something. The evening that I realized I was waiting for Molly to come back, I put my head down on my arms and wept useless, bitter tears. I only came back to myself when I felt a soft hand patting my shoulder and heard her voice saying,
"It can't be changed, dear. It can't be changed. You must let go of the past."
I lifted my head and looked at my little daughter. I had thought her asleep on the hearth. It was the first time she had touched me of her own volition. Her eyes were such a pale blue, like Ketrikan's, and sometimes she did seem, not blind, but as if she looked past me into another place. Her words were not ones I would have expected from a child. They were Molly's words, the words she would have spoken to me to comfort me. My little child, trying to be strong for me. I blinked my eyes clear of tears, cleared my throat, and asked her, "Would you like to learn how to play stones?"
"Of course,"
she said, and even though I knew she didn't mean it, I taught her that night, and we played until it was almost morning. We both slept in until early noon the next day. The message came, delivered in the usual way as autumn was winding to a close. When I sat down at the breakfast table with Bee, there was a fat brown acorn with two oak leaves still attached to it on the table. Once, I had carved such a motif on the top of a little box where I kept my poisons, the kit of my trade as an assassin. The box was long gone, but the meaning was the same. Shade wished to meet with me. I scowled at the acorn. For as long as I'd lived at Withywoods, he'd been able to do this. No one on the staff would admit to putting the acorn on the table, nor to leaving a door unbarred or a window unlatched. Yet there it was, a reminder from my old mentor that no matter how clever and wary I thought myself, he could still steal through my defences if he wished to. He'd be waiting for me by evening at an inn called the Oaken Staff at a crossroads near Gallows Hill. That was a 2-hour ride away, which meant that if I kept the rendezvous, I would be very late returning, perhaps not getting back until dawn if this was one of Shade's convoluted discussions. Whatever it was, he was not going to skill to me about it. That meant no one in the coterie knew of it. It was another of his damned secrets, then. Bee watched me handling the acorn. When I set it back on the table, she picked it up to examine it. She had begun to use small phrases to the staff.
"Please, more bread."
Or a simple,
"Good morning."
Her childish lisp was not entirely pretense, but I was not sure if I felt pride or dismay at how polished an actress she was. In the last few evenings, we had played our memory game as well as stones, and at both she seemed incredibly gifted. I tutted at my fatherly pride, reminding myself that every parent must think his child the cleverest and prettiest. She had shown me a page from an herbal that she had copied out with painstaking care at my urgent request. She had her mother's gift for illustration, and she had written a brief note to Nettle, scarcely blotched at all, and in a hand so like my own that I wondered if her sister would deem it counterfeit. Our last few weeks together had been like balm on a wound. Briefly, it eased the aching. But Shade's summons I could not ignore. The only times when he went back to the cryptic communications of my boyhood were when he had something of the utmost delicacy to broach to me. Was it private to him, or too dangerous to share? My heart sank at the thought. Now what? What was happening at Buckkeep Castle that was worthy of this secret liaison? What was he trying to drag me into? And what arrangements could I make for Bee that evening? If I went to meet Shade, I would not be there to see her to bed that night. We had begun to build something, we two, and I did not want to neglect it. As Nettle had warned me, caring for the child full-time was not as easy as one might think, but neither was it as hard as she had painted it. I was enjoying my daughter, even when we both were in the same room, but quiet and busy at our own tasks. Her latest fancy was a set of brushes and some paints. Her copies of illustrations were painstaking and accurate. She sighed over them, but since I had suggested that Nettle needed to see her abilities, she did them. I was more charmed by the peculiar and childish images she created when left alone with brushes and inks. She had painted a small man with his cheeks puffed as if blowing, and told me that he breathed out fog. She had never seen the ocean or a ship, but had drawn a little boat towed through the waves by water snakes. Another was a row of flowers with tiny faces. She showed me such work shyly, and I sensed she was letting me into her world. I didn't want to leave her for a housemaid to tuck into bed, nor would I drag her out and into the night with me. An autumn storm was threatening. B was looking at me curiously as I pondered my lack of choices.
"What's this?"
she piped in her childish voice and held up the acorn. "An acorn. A seed from an oak tree."
"I know that,"
she said, as if amazed I could think her so ignorant. She silenced herself hastily. Tavia had come out of the kitchen with a steaming kettle of porridge. She set it down on the table and ladled two generous servings into our bowls. A pitcher of cream and a pot of honey were already on the table, beside a loaf of freshly baked dark bread. One of the younger kitchen girls, Elm, followed her with a bowl of butter and a dish of stewed prunes. She did not look at Bee, I noticed. I marked, too, how Bee stiffened slightly and did not breathe as the girl passed behind her chair. I nodded my thanks to Tavia and waited until she had whisked herself and her daughter back to the kitchen before I spoke. "I have to go on a brief trip this evening. I may be gone all night." I felt Bee's eyes flicker over my face, trying to read what I was thinking. It was a new habit she had. She still did not meet my gaze, but sometimes I felt her looking at me. She was relieved that I now attempted to keep my skill contained at all times, but I think it also made me more mysterious to her. I had to wonder how much she had read from me in the first 9 years of her life. The thought was so saddening that I pushed it aside. She had not spoken. "Shall I ask Tavia to put you to bed tonight?" She shook her head briskly. "Mild, then." The other kitchen maid was younger, in her 20s. Perhaps she would suit Bee better. Bee lowered her eyes to her porridge and shook her head more slowly. Well, that cancelled both of my easy solutions, unless I simply told her she'd have to endure whatever arrangements I could make. I wasn't ready to be so firm with her yet. I wondered if I ever would be, and then chided myself to think that I might be the sort of father who spoiled a child by indulging her will. I would think of something, I promised myself, and push the matter from my mind for the time being. Despite Shade's visit looming before me, I went about my regular tasks for the day. The needs of a manor stopped for nothing, not even a death. I was swiftly discovering just how many unseen parts there were to managing a household, even with Revel stepping up to much of it. Molly had always been the one to coordinate with him. Together they had discussed meals and seasonal tasks, routine maintenance, hiring of help. It had all been invisible to me, and now the man and his insistence that we meet each afternoon to discuss the day's needs nearly drove me mad. He was a pleasant enough fellow and good at what he did. But every time he tapped at my study door, it was a reminder that Molly was not there to intercept him. Twice he had brought up maintenance that should be done before winter. The carefully detailed notes he gave me, with suggestions as to tradesmen and material and dates, overwhelmed me. It was all stacked on top of my ordinary work. Today, I was already late paying the staff, and though they had seemed understanding of my grief, I knew that their lives went on. How to manage? Hire yet another person to nag me through the day? I dreaded trying to find someone trustworthy, and my heart sank even deeper as I realized that I still needed to find a nanny or tutor for B as well. I wondered if FitzVigilant was ready yet, and then realized that for a little girl, a woman would be more appropriate. Someone who could sleep in the unused servant's chamber adjacent to her own. Someone who would move from being a nanny to a maid as Bee grew. My woe deepened at the thought of bringing a woman into her life who would do some of what her mother had done for her. I knew I must. Although Shade's visit would be the first task to take me from her side, it would not be the last. I had no idea where to begin looking for a servant who could fulfill such a demanding role. I was silent as I ate, pondering my dilemma, and silent when I rose. For neither the first nor the last time, I considered the strange isolation my peculiar station in life had conferred on me. To the landholders and gentry around Buckkeep, Molly and I had been neither aristocracy nor common folk, but creatures trapped between classes. The men who worked for me as groundskeepers and ostlers spoke of me well and appreciated my first-hand knowledge of their tasks, but they did not consider me a friend. And those nobles with holdings within an easy ride had known us as Holder Tom Badgerlock and Lady Molly. To their eyes, Molly had been elevated only as recognition from the Crown for Burrick's services. They had been pleasant enough when we encountered them, but none had extended invitations to socialize, and Molly had wisely held back from pressing the matter. We'd had each other for daily company, and the irregular invasions of our relatives to inject both chaos and merriment into our lives. It had been enough for us both. But now that she was gone, I looked around myself and perceived how solitary my life at Withy Woods was without her. Our children had gone back to their own lives and left me here alone, all save one. I glanced down at her. It wasn't right for a child to grow up so alone. Bee's little slippers were close to silent as she ghosted along behind me through the house. I glanced back at her and said, "I have to go out to the stables, and a storm is waiting. Let's get you into some warm clothes."
"I can do that myself," she insisted softly.
"Can you reach everything?" I frowned. Were her winter things still stored in a chest somewhere? Would they still fit her? She thought about it for a moment, and then nodded consideringly. She tilted her head up, and I felt her gaze brush across me.
"I'm not as little as I look. I'm 9.
"Very well. I'll wait for you in my private study." She bobbed her head in grave acknowledgement, and I watched her hasten up the stairs. It was a climb for her, a reach for every step. I tried to imagine being so small in a world scaled for adults, and could not. She was a very capable child, I thought to myself, and wondered if I was underestimating her. There was a danger in asking too much of a child, but the danger of asking too little was almost equal. Nonetheless, provision should be made for her, lest she need me, and I not be there to protect her. I reached a decision. When she came into my study, she was wearing her boots and warm leggings, with her winter cloak slung over her arm. Her hair was pulled back into a stubby tail. I could tell she had done it herself and did not criticize it. She looked around the room, obviously wondering why we were there so early in the day. The room was smaller than the formal study, but pleasant enough. The walls were rich dark wood, and the hearth was built of big flat river stones. It was a comfortable room, a man's retreat. But that was not why I had chosen it for my den. I considered and hesitated. But she was 9, the same age I had been when Buckkeep Castle's secret had been shared with me. "Please close the door behind you," I told her as she came in. She did so, and then looked past my shoulder, wondering at my odd request.
"I thought we were going out."
"We are, but not right away. I want to show you something and see if you can do it. But first I have to explain it. Sit down, please." She climbed up to sit on one of the cushioned chairs and perched there, watching me, but not meeting my eyes. "This is a secret," I warned her. "It's a secret only for you and me. Patience showed it to your mother and me when we first came here. Patience is gone, and now Molly is gone too. I waited, swallowed, and went on. So only I know about this now, and soon you will too. It's not written down anywhere, and it must never be put on paper. You cannot show it to anyone else. Do you understand? For a time she was very still. Then she nodded slowly. I got up from my seat behind the desk, went to the door, and made sure it was latched. This door has to be shut completely, I told her. I touched the hinges of the massive door. Look here. This door has four hinges, two at the top and two closer to the bottom. They all look just the same. I waited, and again she nodded gravely. This one, not the lowest one, but this one above it, is false. When you pull the pin out of the top of this hinge, it becomes a handle. See? Then you can do this. I pulled the brass pin out, took hold of the false hinge, and pulled on it. A tall, narrow door disguised as a wood wall panel swung open. Spiderwebs stretched and broke as I pulled it open. Darkness breathed out. I glanced back at B. Her attention was absolute. Her lower lip caught between her small, perfect teeth. It's a secret passageway. Yes? She queried, and I realized I was telling her the obvious. I scratched my cheek and felt how deep my beard had grown. I'd still not trimmed it, I suddenly realized, and Molly had not rebuked me. All thoughts fled my mind for a moment as a wave of loss drenched and drowned me again.
Papa?
B tugged at my shirt cuff. I'm sorry, I said, and drew breath again.
I'm sorry, too, she said.
She did not take my hand, but held on to my cuff. I had not even been aware of her getting down from the chair or crossing the room to me. She cleared her little throat, and I became aware of the glistening tracks on her cheeks. I tightened my skill walls, and she nodded a silent thanks to me. In a low voice she asked me,
"Where does it go?"
And so together we crested that wave of sorrow and pushed on. It goes to a little room above and to the left of the hearth. There's a tiny peephole there, so someone could sit there and watch people come and go and talk in this room. I rub my eyes. And from that little room, there is a narrow stair that goes to a very low crawlway. And it goes to other little spy rooms in other parts of the house. I swallowed and my voice became almost normal as I added, I think it's a farseer obsession. We seem to like spy halls and secret places in our homes. She nodded, staring past me at the door. The broken cobweb stirred in a slight draft. A smile dawned on her face, and she actually clasped her little hands together under her chin.
I love it. Is it for me?
It was the last reaction I could have predicted from her. I found my smile answering hers. It is now, I told her. There are two other ways to get into it. One from my bedroom, and another from a pantry. Those are both difficult to open, mostly because they haven't been used in a very, very long time. This one is easier, but it too hasn't been used in a long time, so it will be full of cobwebs and dust and mice and spiders. She had advanced to the edge of the passageway. She flapped a hand through the dangling webs and then shook her fingers free of the rags, undaunted by small things with many legs. A glance back in my direction.
Can I go in now? Can I take a lamp?
I suppose so. Her enthusiasm had caught me off guard. I had thought only to seed an idea with her today, to show her a place to retreat to if she was ever in danger and I was not around to protect her. I shot the concealed bolts on the study doors so that no one could enter. I took the lamp from my desk. Then I shut the door to the passage and dropped the hinge pin back into its place. You try to open it. The pin was stubborn, and it took some tugging before she freed it.
We can oil that,
she said breathlessly, and then stood up to pull the panel open. She glanced back at me.
Can I take the lamp and go first?
If she fell and dropped the lamp, the spilled oil and flame would set all of Withywood's afire. Be careful, I told her as I handed it to her. Use both hands and don't fall.
I won't,
she replied. But as soon as it was in her hands, I doubted my wisdom in entrusting it to her. She was so obviously excited and focused only on exploring. She walked unhesitatingly into the narrow, dark corridor. I stooped and followed her. The spy passages of Withywood's were not nearly as elaborate as the ones that threaded Buckkeep Castle. I think if they had been my father's handiwork, he would have made them for a taller man. I suspected they dated back to the first rebuilding of the house, when they had added the south wing. I'd often wondered if there were more of them, the secret of opening the doors lost in the process of the house changing inhabitants. The passage had a short landing and then a steep stair. At the top of the stair, there was a landing and a sharp turn to the left. There the passage became slightly wider. It went up 6 more steps and then was flat until it reached the area beside the hearth. I could not stand straight in the little compartment, but someone had been comfortable there once. There was a short, sturdy stool for him to perch on while he did his spying, a little cabinet of dark wood, its doors securely closed, and a small shelf where Bea set down her lamp. Her instinct was correct. I noticed now the little guard around the peephole that would keep the lamplight from being visible. She sat down on the stool without dusting it off, leaned forward to peer into my study, then leaned back and proclaimed,
I love it. It fits me perfectly. Oh, Papa, thank you.
She stood up and went to the little cupboard, reaching the handle easily. She peered inside.
Look, here's an ink pot. It's all dried up, but I could put ink in it. And here's an old quill pen, all eaten away to its spine. I'll need a fresh one. Look, the shelf folds down and now it's a little table for writing. How clever! Is it truly all for me?
What had probably been a rather cramped space, even for a small spy, did fit her perfectly. The space I had thought of as an emergency retreat for her, she saw as a refuge, perhaps even a playroom. It's a safe place for you, a place to come and hide if you feel you're in danger and you can't get to me, or if I tell you there is danger and you must run and hide. She looked at me earnestly, not meeting my eyes, but her pale gaze wandering over my face.
I see. Of course. Well, then, I shall need candles and a tinderbox, and something to keep water in, and something with a tight lid for keeping hard bread, so that I shall not be hungry if I had to hide here for quite a long time, and a cushion and a blanket against the chill, and perhaps a few books.
I stared at her aghast. No! No, Bea, I'd never leave you hidden here for days at a time. Wait, a few books? Do you truly read that well? The expression on her face would not have been as surprised if I'd asked her if she could breathe.
Of course. Can't everyone?
No. Generally, one has to be taught to read. I know your mother showed you letters, but I didn't think... I stared at her in amazement. I had watched her at play with her pen and her book, thinking that she did no more than practice random letters. The note she had written to her sister had been a simple one, just a few lines. I now recalled she had asked for paper so she could write down her dreams. I thought she had meant her odd drawings. I quelled my sudden desire to know what she wrote, to see what she dreamed. I would wait until she offered to share it with me.
Mama read to me. Her big, beautiful book about herbs and flowers. The one Lady Patience gave her. She read it very slowly, pointing at each word. She had told me the letters and the sounds. So I learned.
Molly had come to reading late and mastered it with great difficulty. And I knew immediately the book she had read to be, one that had not pages of paper, but narrow slabs of wood with the words and the illustrations engraved in them, and the herbs and flowers carved and then painted in their correct colours. Patience had treasured that gift from me, and Molly had taught our daughter to read from it.
Papa?
I had been wool gathering. I looked down at her.
What happened to Lady Patience? Mama told me many stories about her, but never the end of her story.
The end of her story? I had been there the day my stepmother's story had ended. I thought of it now, and it suddenly took on a completely different significance to me. I cleared my throat. Well, it was a day in early spring. The plum trees had begun to waken from the winter, and Lady Patience wanted them pruned before the buds burst into flowers. She was quite an old lady by then, but still very fussy about her gardens, so she insisted on leaning out an upper window and shouting instructions to the workers pruning her trees. I had to smile at the memory. Bee was almost looking at me, her face intent with interest, her brow wrinkled.
Did she fall out the window?
No. For a wonder, no, she didn't fall. But she wasn't happy with how they were doing the pruning, so she declared that she was going to make them do it as she wished, and to bring back some of the trimmings to force into bloom for the table. I offered to go fetch her some, but no, she was off to her room, and then came clumping back down in her boots and a heavy wool cloak, and out she went. I paused. I remembered it all so clearly. The blue sky, the blustery wind, and Patience's eyes snapping with indignation that the orchard crew was ignoring her.
Then what?
She was gone for a little while. I was in the morning room when I heard the door slam. She was calling for me to come and take some of the cuttings. I stepped out in the hall, and here she came with a great armful of them, dropping twigs and bits of moss as she went. I was going to take them from her, when she suddenly stopped where she was. She stared, and her mouth fell open, and her cheeks that were pink with cold went even pinker. Then she shouted, "Chivalry? There you are!" And she flung up her arms, and the branches went everywhere. She opened her arms wide and took two running steps past me, and then she fell. Tears suddenly prickled my eyes. I blinked, but could not stop them.
"And she was dead,"
Bee whispered. "Yes," I said hoarsely. I recalled the loose weight of her as I gathered her and turned her face up in my arms. She was dead and staring, but smiling still. Smiling.
"She thought you were her dead husband when she saw you."
"No," I shook my head. "She didn't look at me. She was looking past me, down the hallway behind me. I don't know what she saw."
"She saw him,"
Bee decided with great satisfaction. She nodded to herself.
"He came to get her at last. It's a good end to her story. May I keep her book up here, the one of herbs?"
I wondered if Molly would come to get me some day. A fluttering of hope rose in me. Then I came back to myself, to the little room and my daughter sitting at the folded-down desktop. "You could keep books up here if you wish. You may keep anything here that you want. You may have candles and a tinderbox, if you promise to be very careful with them. But you must remember, this room and its entrance are a secret, one that is not to be shared with anyone. Only you and I know that it exists. It's important that it stays our secret." She nodded gravely.
"Can you show me where the other passage goes, the one we passed, and how to open the other doors?"
"Perhaps tomorrow. Right now we must close it up snug, and then go see the man who takes care of the sheep."
"Lynn,"
she reminded me casually.
"Shepherd Lynn takes care of the sheep."
"Yes, Lynn. We need to talk to him." An idea blossomed in my mind. He has a son named Boge, who has a wife and a little girl at his house. Perhaps you would like to meet them.
"No, thank you."
Her crisp reply killed that hope. I knew there would be more to that story. I waited in patient silence as she took up our lamp and led us down the narrow stair. She paused hopefully at the intersection to the other passage, lifting her lamp to peer into the darkness, but then with a short sigh, led us back down to my study. I held the lamp as she closed the panel and secured it. Then I blew out the lamp and drew open the heavy curtains to let in the grey light. It was raining. I blinked as my eyes adjusted and realized we must have had a frost in the night. The leaves had begun to change, with the edges and veins of the birch leaves turning gold. Winter was drawing closer. I still hadn't spoken.
Other children don't like me. I make them uncomfortable. They think I'm a tiny child dressed up as a girl. And then when I can do things, like pare apples with a sharp knife, they think... I don't know what they think. But when I go into the kitchen, Tavia's sons go out. They used to come to work with her every day. They don't anymore.
She looked away from me.
Elm and Leah, the kitchen girls, hate me.
Oh, Bee, they don't hate you. They hardly know you. And Tavia's sons are of an age where they go with their father now to learn what he does all day. It's not you, Bee. I was looking down at my small daughter with a sympathetic smile. She glanced up at me, and for the instant that our eyes met, the blue anger in hers burned me. She looked down at the floor, her whole body stiff.
"Perhaps I shall stay in out of the rain today," she said in an icy little voice. "It might be a good day to stay by myself."
"Bee," I said, but before I could go on, that fury was flashed at me again.
"I hate it when you lie. You know that other children will fear me, and I know when they hate me. It's not something I pretend. It's real. Don't lie to me to make me think that I'm the one who is judging them badly. Lies are bad, no matter who tells them. Mama put up with it from you, but I shan't."
She folded her arms across her chest and stood staring defiantly at my knees. "Bee, I am your father. You cannot speak to me like that."
"If I cannot be honest with you, I shall not speak to you at all."
All the force of her will was behind her words. I knew that she was completely capable of resuming her long silence. The thought of being deprived of the only companionship I'd found since Molly's death struck me so deep a blow that I immediately recognized how close a bond I was forming with my daughter. The second bolt of lightning was how dangerous it would be to both of us if I let my need for her company overcome my duty to be her parent. "You can be honest with me and still respect me, as I can with you. You are different, Bee. It will make some parts of your life very difficult. But if you always fall back on your differences to explain everything you dislike about the world, you will fall into self-pity. I've no doubt that you did make Tavia's boys uneasy, but I also know that neither one of them liked working in the kitchens, and so their father took them down to the mill to see if that suited them better. It is not always all about you. Sometimes you are just one factor." She lowered her eyes to the floor. She did not uncross her arms. "Get your cloak on. We're going down to see Lynn." I gave the order confidently, holding in my anguish over what I would do if she refused to obey. When Starling had given Hap to me, he'd led such a life of privation that he was pathetically grateful to sleep inside and be given food. He'd been well past 10 before we'd had any confrontations about my authority. The thought of physically disciplining a creature as small as Bee filled me with revulsion, yet I knew I had to win this battle. I concealed my relief when she retrieved her cloak and put it on. I didn't say anything to nettle her pride as we left the study and went out onto the grounds. I did shorten my stride as we walked out to the pastures and the sheds. She still had to trot to keep up with me. Lynn was waiting for me. He showed me 3 sheep that he'd isolated from the flock after they'd developed a rash that had them rubbing themselves raw on trees and fence posts. I knew little of sheep, but Lynn had been tending them since he was a youth, and his hair was now as grey as most of his woolly charges. So I listened and nodded, and asked him to keep me informed if any more of the ewes became infected. As we spoke, his eyes wandered from me to my small charge, and then back again. Bee, perhaps still smarting from being corrected, stood small and stiff and silent throughout our conversation. Lynn's dog, Daisy, wandered over to inspect her. When Bee stepped back at her approach, she wagged her tail appreciatively, and her tongue lolled with dog laughter.
So easy to herd.
I chose to ignore them as Daisy backed my daughter into a corner and then prodded her with a nose, her tail wagging all the while. Lynn glanced at them apprehensively, but I walked over to a ewe and asked Lynn how old she was. Distracted, he came to me. I asked if mites might be causing the irritation, making Lynn furrow his brow and go down to part the sheep's wool and look for insects. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Bee reach out to fondle one of the dog's silky little ears. Daisy sat down and leaned against her. Bee buried her chilled hands into the dog's thick golden ruff, and I saw suddenly that she and the dog were easy and familiar with each other. Her earlier backing away from the dog had not been apprehension, but an invitation to their game. I listened to Lynn recount the ewe's earlier symptoms with only half my attention. When Lynn was satisfied that I'd heard his worries and had confidence in what he was doing, our meeting was over. I'd never enjoyed sheep and had little to do with their care when I was growing up at Buckkeep Castle, so I did with Lynn what Burrick had done with the hawk tenders at Buckkeep. I'd found a good man who knew more about the woolly knotheads than I'd ever care to learn, and entrusted Nettle's flocks to him. But hearing him out did take a time, and I felt my mourning fleeing. When I turned around to look for Bee, she was not there. Daisy was sitting calmly. My reaction was instinctive. I reached out to both dog and man as I asked, "Where is she? Where did my daughter go?" "Kittens," they responded as one. If Lynn was witted and Daisy his beast partner, he had never told me, and now was not a time to ask. He would not be the first unwitted man I'd met who behaved as if he and his partner could speak to each other. But my concern was not with them, but Bee.
"Kittens!"
"There is a litter back there under one of the mangers. Got their eyes open 2 weeks ago, and now they've started to explore." Indeed they had, and the litter of four kits was exploring my daughter as she lay on her belly in the damp straw and let them climb on her. An orange and white one sat on her back and pulled her hair, his pin teeth set in her scruffy hair and his small feet braced. Two calicos were in the curve of her arms under her chin. At a short distance, a black and white kit with a kink in his tail glared at her as she stared back at him. "Bee, it's time to go," I warned her. She moved slowly, reluctantly. I reached down to unfasten the orange kitten from her hair. It smacked me experimentally. I set it on the straw beside her. "We need to go now," I prodded her. She sighed.
"I like the kittens. I've never held one before. These ones are nice, but that one won't let me touch him."
Lynn spoke. "Oh, that blackie is like his father, full of piss and vinegar already. He'll be a good ratter, but I wouldn't choose him, Mistress Bee." "We're not choosing any of them," I corrected him. "She just wanted to hold one." Ling cocked his head at me. At his side, his dog mimicked him. "Well, I'm just saying she's welcome to one of them if you want him. They're the right age to find a new home. Their mother is tired of them, and they've started a hunt. And a little friend might be a comfort to the little girl, sir. A warm little bit of company." He cleared his throat and added, "Though I think a pup would be better for her." I knew a moment of impatience. A kitten or puppy would not cure her grief over her mother's death. Then a sharp memory of a pup named Nosy intruded into my mind. But another young creature to be her friend could help, a lot, and perhaps in all the wrong ways. I spoke firmly. "Thank you, but no, Lynn. Perhaps when she's a bit older, but not now. Come, Bee. We need to get back to the house." I expected a plea from her. Instead, she sat up, gently letting the pair of calicos slide back into the straw. A moment longer she stared at the black kitten. She pointed one finger at him, as if to warn him, but then stood up the rest of the way and followed obediently as I left the sheep sheds. I slowed my pace even more on our walk back to the house.
So, what did you hear? I asked B.
She was silent for a long time. I was on the point of pushing for a response when she admitted,
I wasn't really paying attention. It was just about sheep. It wasn't about me. And there were the kittens.
We talked about sheep that belong to your sister, with a man who makes his living taking care of those sheep. Some day you may have to walk down there to talk to him, or to his daughter or grandchild about those sheep. Next time, you listen. I paused to give her a moment to mull that, and then asked, So you didn't hear this time. What did you see? She surprised me in what she had heard me say. My question had not entered her mind at all. She spoke hesitantly, in a voice full of trepidation.
So, Withy Woods does not belong to you, or to me. It's Nettle's house, and they are Nettle's sheep. They'll never be mine. Or the grapes, or the orchards. None of it is really mine. Nettle was Mama's eldest, and she now owns it all. But some day I may have to take care of all of it for her, just as you do.
She pondered a moment.
Papa, when I am grown and you are dead, what will belong to me?
An arrow to my heart. What would belong to this odd child of mine? Even if I set aside a good marriage portion for her, would she grow to be a woman that a man would wish to wed? A good man? How would I find him, or know him when I had? When I was dead and gone, what would befall her? Years ago, Shade had asked me the same thing, and I had replied she was but a baby, and it was too soon to worry. 9 years had passed since then. Another 9, and she would be eligible for marriage. And I was a procrastinating idiot. I spoke quickly to fill my long silence. I am sure that your sister and brothers would never allow you to live in want, I told her, and I was confident that I spoke truth to her.
That's not the same as knowing there would be something that was mine,
she said quietly. I knew she was right. Before I could assure her that I would do my best to see that she was provided for, she spoke again.
This is what I saw. I saw sheep and sheep dung and straw. I saw lots of wool on the lower rungs of the fence and lots of little spiders, red and black, on the bottom sides of the rungs. I saw one ewe lying down, and she had rubbed all the wool and some of her skin off her rump. Another ewe was rubbing her hip on a fence post and licking her lips while she did it.
I was nodding, pleased at her observation. She gave me a glance, looked aside, and added,
And I saw Lynn looking at me, and then looking away, as if I was something he'd rather not see.
He was, I agreed, but not in dislike. He's sad for you. He liked you enough to think you should have a kitten or a puppy of your own. Look at how he is with his own dog, and you'll see that isn't something he'd suggest for a child he disliked. She made a skeptical noise in her throat. When I was a boy, I told her calmly, I hated being a bastard. I thought that whenever anyone looked at me, that was the first thought he had. So I made being a bastard the most important thing about me. And whenever I met anyone, the first thing I thought of was how he was thinking about meeting a bastard. We walked for a time in silence. I could tell she was already tired. I caught myself thinking I'd have to build her endurance with regular challenges, and then reminded myself that she was not a dog nor a horse, but my child. Sometimes, I added carefully, I decided that people didn't like me before they had had a chance to decide for themselves, so I didn't speak to them or make any effort to have them like me.
Being a bastard is something that doesn't show unless you make it show,
she said. She gestured at herself.
I can't hide this. Being small and looking younger than I am. Being pale where most folk are dark. Being able to talk as if I'm older than I am is something I can hide. But you said I shouldn't do that.
No, Some of your differences you can't hide. Little by little, you can let people see that you're a lot more intelligent than most children of your age, and that will make you less frightening to them. Again that sound of disdain. Were you scared of Daisy? I asked her.
Daisy?
The herd dog. Did she scare you?
No, of course not. She does like to poke me with her nose, but Daisy's nice.
How do you know? A hesitation before she replied.
She wagged her tail, and she wasn't afraid of me.
A pause.
May I have a puppy?
Not where I wanted the conversation to go, but again it was inevitable. It would be hard for me to let you have a dog just now. Not while my heart was so desperately lonely still. Not while I reached out, whether I would or not, to any creature that looked at me with sympathetic eyes. Even if I did not bond, the dog would be drawn to me, not her. No. Perhaps in the future we can talk about it again. But what I wanted you to see... Are you tired? Shall I carry you? Her walk had slowed to a trudge, and her cheeks were bright red with effort and the chill wind's kiss. She straightened her spine.
I'm nearly 10. I'm too old to be carried, she said with great dignity.
Not by your father, I said, and swooped her up. She went stiff in my arms, as she always did, but I was relentless. I set her up high on my left shoulder and lengthened my stride. She perched there, speechless and stiff as a stick. I thought I perceived her problem. I took a breath and walled myself in tighter. It wasn't easy. For a moment I was as disoriented as if I had suddenly discarded my sense of smell or sight. When one has the wit, to use it is instinctive, and the skill wells over and out of the untrained. But I was rewarded by her relaxing a trifle, and then exclaiming,
I can see so far! Can you see this far all the time? Well, I suppose you can. How wonderful it is!
She was so pleased and excited that I hadn't the heart to drag her back to my lecture. Another time would be soon enough, I promised myself. She had just lost her mother, and she and I were only now discovering how to reach out to each other. Tomorrow, I would talk with her again about how to put others at ease. For now, I would enjoy a moment when she seemed an ordinary child, and I could simply be her father. Chapter 12 Explorations. Once there was an old woman who lived all alone in the middle of a busy city. She made her living as a washerwoman for several wealthy merchant families. Each day, she would go to one of their homes, gather the dirty clothing, and take it to her own home, where she would scrub and pound it clean, spread it to dry on her thatched roof, and do whatever mending might be required. It did not afford her a good livelihood, but she liked her work because she could do it by herself. She had not always been alone. Once, she had had a dog. The dog had been her wit beast and her friend. But no dog lives forever, and few live as long as a human, and so the sad day came when the woman found herself alone. And alone she had been ever since then. Or so she thought. Early one morning, as she clambered from her bed, she slipped and fell, and when she tried to stand up, she could not, for she had broken her leg high at the hip. She called for help, but no one heard her, and no one came. All that day and the night and the next day she lay on the floor. She grew faint with hunger, and thirst took her voice away. Her mind began to wander, and she ran the streets of the city as her dog once had. Now, as a dog, and in her dream, she met a young man, and said to him, My mistress has need of your aid. Follow me, please. I beg of you. She woke to a man holding a cup of cool water to her lips. I dreamed a dog, and he brought me here, he told her. He saved her life, and though she mended but slowly and always walked with a stick and a hitch, ever after that, they were friends. Bajalog's old blood tales. When I was sure my father was well and truly on his way, I slid out of my bed, took one of my mother's scented candles from the supply in the bedside table, and kindled it at the fire. I put it into a holder and set it on the floor while I got a warm woolen robe from my winter clothing chest. I didn't like the big storage chest. The lid was beautifully carved with birds and flowers, but it was heavy. I was not tall enough to open it all the way, so I had to hold it up with one hand while I rummaged in the depths with the other. Fortunately, there was a robe close to the top, and the prickly touch of the wool against my fingers told me it was the one I wanted. I fished it up and leapt back, letting the lid of the chest fall with a thump. Tomorrow, I decided, I would ask my father to prop the chest open for me so that I could move warm clothing from it to the smaller chest he had made for me. The night's storm surely meant winter was on its way. It was time to make the changes. I pulled the robe on over my nightdress and then put on my warm stockings. I didn't bother with shoes. My house shoes were too tight to go over the thick wool, and my old boots too heavy for what I had in mind. I picked up my candle, opened the door, and peered out into the corridor. All was quiet. I slipped out, letting the door shut softly behind me. Finally, I would have the leisure to explore the secret passageway as thoroughly as I wished. Ever since I had glimpsed it, I had thought of nothing else. I had wanted to return there directly as soon as we came back from the sheep pens, but there had been a meal to eat, and then my father had kept me by his side as he worried and fretted that he would have to leave me alone that night. So silly. Was not I alone every night when he sat in his study or slept in his bed? What difference did it make that he was far from our home? The banked embers of the hearth fire in my father's study had burned low. I added another log, as much for light as warmth. I took two tall candles from the drawer of his desk. Then I carefully did as he had done earlier, making sure that the drapery at the window was tightly closed, latching the study doors, and working the secret catch on the false hinge. When the narrow door opened, the house breathed out at me, a chill breath of old secrets. I breathed it in and felt them fill me. Candle holder in hand, I started up the narrow way. I went first to the small room my father had shown me. I investigated it more carefully, but found little that I hadn't seen before. It was pleasant to sit there alone, the candle making a yellow pool of light around me, while I thought of how I would put my book on the little shelf and my inkpot and pen beside them. I had never realized how much I had longed for a space of my very own. My bedroom had always seemed a vast and chilly space to me, little different from trying to sleep in the middle of the table in the dining hall. Here, I felt cozy and sheltered. I resolved that the next time I came here, I would bring a duster to sweep away cobwebs and make it all tidy, and a cushion and blanket to make it cozy. I would make pictures to go on the walls. It was very satisfying to imagine the space made over to suit me exactly, and I lingered so long at that pursuit that my scented candle burned low. I kindled one of the tapers I had taken from my father's desk. I quickly resolved that a supply of them must be kept here. No time like the present. I put my extra taper onto the little shelf and turned to pinch out the small flame on what was left of the scented candle. A tiny wisp of fragrant smoke rose from it, scenting the air. I set the stub on my desk and put the lit taper in the holder. I should bring some of the sachets my mother and I had made, some of the rose and honeysuckle ones. I would fill the little cabinet with all the things I wished to keep here. Dried apricots and raisins, the hard little sausages that I loved to chew. It would be cozy and comfortable, a place to read or draw or write. My own tiny room. The fresh candle reminded me of the passing time. I wanted to explore the other passageway that I had only glimpsed earlier. I recalled that my father said it led to two other entrances, one in his bedroom and one in the pantry.
The pantry was on the lower floor behind the kitchens, while my parents' chamber was in the main part of the house and upstairs. So at some point there must be stairs, I reasoned, and immediately decided that I would explore that passage. I returned to the intersection that I had earlier glimpsed, and this time, instead of going back to the study, I followed the other passage. I noticed that the passageway was walled with dark planked wood here, and wondered if it was older than the first section I had explored. As my father had warned me, it had not been used in quite some time. Draping cobwebs sizzled and twitched as they met my candle's flame. The passage bent first one way and then another as it followed the walls of the chambers. At one point, the wall of the passage was brick and mortar and very cold. Drafts made the flame of my candle dance, and I shielded it with my hand. I felt that perhaps I was now in the main part of the house. I hurried along, passing the bared bones of a mouse, dead so long there was no stink to him. I found two more peepholes, each shuttered with a tiny lid. I set my candle down and endeavoured to see where I was. But try as I might, I could see nothing of the darkened rooms they spied on. Indeed, I had only a hazy idea of where I was in the house, and could not tell if I passed bedchambers or sitting rooms. I came to a place where the passage diverged into not two, but three possible paths. So perhaps there were more entrances to the spy tunnels than my father had told me. The first one I chose was a disappointment. It did not go far before it came to a peephole and another little bench beneath it. Again, I set my candle down, and after a short struggle, I managed to push the stubborn cover to one side. I was astonished to find I was looking into my own bedchamber. The fire was burning low, but it still cast enough light for me to see by. I was on the hearth wall of my room, where I could look down on the bed. I wondered if there was a secret entrance to my bedroom, and carefully felt all along the nearby wall for some catch or hinge. But if there was one, I did not find it, which was very disappointing. I had become quite excited at the idea of being able to access my new refuge from my bedroom. I returned to the intersection of the tunnels, resolving not to dawdle, for my candle was almost half gone. A lamp was what I needed for future exploration. I was certain that my father would allow me neither to possess my own lamp, nor to wander through the walls of Withywoods with a borrowed one. I wondered if he would notice it if I took the one from my mother's sewing room. He had avoided that room since her death. I felt a pang of conscience at the thought of going behind his back to get what I needed, but not a large one. I was quite certain that he considered me far less capable than I was. Did that mean I should limit myself to what he thought I could do? I didn't think so. I chose a path at random and followed it. It wound for quite a way through the walls, and twice I negotiated what would have been very tight corners for an adult. I went down some crude steps, then up, and a short time later down a longer slant. I encountered more evidence of vermin and halted once when I heard small feet scampering away from me. I do not care for rats and mice. Rats do not stink as badly as mice do, but I do not like their beady eyes. The droppings along the wall edges grew thicker, and the urine stink stronger. I found two gnawed holes in the passage. Obviously the rodents had discovered this safe and easy passage and had been using it, by which I deduced that this one would lead to the pantry. And it did. My candle was now just a quarter of its length, and I resolved that I should exit the passage here before it gutted out and left me in darkness. The lever to open the panel was obvious, and though it was stiff, I heaved on it until I heard a click in the wall. I pushed at what I judged was the door, but it moved only a handspan. It was designed to swing out, and when I put my hand out through the opening, I clearly felt that sacks of something, peas or beans, had been stacked against it. I pushed against them, but they were heavy and unyielding. I would not get out that way. It was time to leave my warren. I closed the secret panel to the pantry and headed back the way I had come, feeling both chilled and sleepy. I walked into a heavy cobweb and had to stop to clear it from my eyes. My robe, I noticed, was now very dusty and coated in webbing. I wondered if I could clean it myself and avoid the questions, for I was certain my father would not approve of this solo exploration. I reached the intersection and turned to go back to my father's study. My feet were chilled, and cold was starting to creep up my legs. I felt a tickling on my neck and nearly dropped my candle. I set it down and with my fingers combed spiderweb from my hair. I did not find the spider despite several moments of futile searching. I took up my candle and walked on. The dimness of the passage seemed to make my eyelids feel heavier. It would be good to be back in my room and under my blankets. I set my candle down again to clear more cobwebs from my path. I continued down the corridor and turned a corner before it occurred to me that there should no longer be spiderwebs in my way if I were retracing my steps. I halted where I was, lifted my candle, and peered ahead down the narrow way. No, there was no sign that I had passed this way earlier. The cobwebs were undisturbed, as was the dust on the floor. I turned back, pleased to note that my footprints and the drag of my robe were obvious here. Finding my way back was no trick at all now, and I stepped up my pace. The candle was down to a stub in the holder when I reached the intersection. I thought angrily of how I had left my other candle at my little desk in the first spy hole. Well, it was not so far to go, and soon I would be back in my father's study. I thought longingly of the fireplace, and hoped that the log I had put on the hearth was still burning. I hurried along, following my own tracks. The dark planked walls seemed to lean in closer as my candle faltered. I tipped it a little to allow some of the wax to run off in the holder. Now the wick stood taller and the flame longer, but I could also see the bottom of the melted wax. A wandering draught from the masonry wall nearly blew it out. I set my hand to shelter the flame and then stood stock still, wondering. Had I turned the wrong way? Wasn't the masonry wall on the way to the pantry entrance? Or had it been along the passageway that led to the peephole in my bedroom? I blinked my weary eyes and suddenly could not remember. My tracks in the corridor were no help. The mouse skeleton. Where had I seen the mouse skeleton? I stood staring at my dying flame. Next time, I said to the gathering darkness, next time I shall bring chalk and mark where each passage goes. The draught from the masonry wall was fingering its way through my robe. I turned back the way I had come. I could not hurry now, for the flame was a dancing mite on the last bit of wick. Once I reached that first intersection, I promised myself I would be fine. Even if my candle went out, I could find my way back to the secret cubby by touch. Couldn't I? I banished from my thoughts any fear of rats. My light had chased them away, and surely they never ventured this far from the kitchens. Rats stayed where there was food. Unless they were hungry and looking for more food. Something touched my foot. I leapt, ran two steps, and then fell, splattering hot wax as my candle snuffed out. Darkness rushed in to drown me. It filled the space where my candlelight had held it back. For a moment, I could not breathe, but there was darkness instead of air. I pulled my feet up into my robe, terrified that rats might leap onto them and bite my toes off. My heart was beating so hard it shook my whole body. In the dark, I sat up, shaking my burned hand and clawing the goblets of wax from it. I looked all round, but the blackness was absolute. The darkness pressed on me, a substance that I could not breathe or push away. Terror rose in me. Mama! I shrieked. And then suddenly the reality of her death was all around me, as thick and choking as the darkness. She was gone, and there was no one who could rescue me. Darkness and death became the same thing to me. Mama! 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 Over and over.